Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Brandon Carr of the Quincy Institute and Kevin Harris, Associate Professor of Sociology at UCLA, who discuss their views on the fragile Iran war ceasefire and the future of negotiations to end the conflict. Bishop William Barber, Director of Yale Divinity School's Center for Public Theology and Public Policy, who responds to President Trump's social media posts threatening to annihilate Iran's civilization and attacks on Pope Leo. And Julie Holler with the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a critical look at U.S. corporate media's flawed coverage of the Trump Republican Party voter suppression campaign designed to rig the outcome of the 2026 election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the Islamic Republic's response, closing the Strait of Hormuz, had sent the world into crisis over the interruption of oil and gas supplies from Gulf states. But beyond the skyrocketing price of fossil fuels, the disruption of shipping traffic through the strait is devastating global food security. Because one-third of the world's fertilizer transits through the strait, farmers around the world are experiencing a massive immediate shortage and soaring prices for nitrogen-based fertilizers. Fears of food shortages and shrinking stockpiles are on the rise, particularly in developing countries. The World Food Program has estimated more than 45 million people could be pushed into acute food insecurity if the conflict does not end by June. The Guardian reports that South Asian countries such as India and Sri Lanka are particularly vulnerable to shortages of imported fertilizers and imported gas and fuel needed for farming. India is the world's second largest fertilizer consumer after China, using more than 60 million tons annually. Many Indian farmers, already crushed by debt and under stress due to rising costs, have started hoarding fertilizer supplies. Across the U.S., local battles are being fought over how states and cities can compensate for the loss of federal funds resulting from deep Medicaid and food assistance cuts by President Trump and the Republican Congress to pay for huge tax breaks to the nation's wealthiest families and profitable corporations. Although Chicago's progressive mayor, Brandon Johnson, proposed a payroll tax on large corporations, city council opposition forced the mayor to adopt regressive taxes and other measures to fill a $1.2 billion deficit last December. However, Washington State progressive activists won a major campaign to impose a new millionaire's tax championed by a community labor coalition. The measure, signed into law on March 30th, is expected to generate at least $3 billion for K-12 education, healthcare, and other essential services impacted by federal cuts. In California, the SEIU Healthcare Workers Union is gathering signatures for a ballot measure on a one-time 5% tax on wealth over $1 billion. If assessed on the state's approximately 200 billionaires, supporters say the tax could prevent the collapse of California's healthcare system, offsetting $100 billion in federal cuts. Supportive economists say states could be the place to test the viability of wealth taxes before they're challenged and reach a hostile U.S. Supreme Court. The youth-led Sunrise Movement, founded to advocate for the Green New Deal and address the climate crisis, is seizing on the U.S.-Israel war in Iran to boost challengers to sitting Democrats, joining a coalition of progressive groups arguing that lawmakers who take money from defense contractors and AIPAC, the Israel lobby group, cannot meaningfully oppose the war. In Denver, Sunrise is endorsing Malat Kiros, an anti-war candidate and attorney who was fired for refusing to take down her social media post opposing the genocide in Palestine. Kiros is challenging longtime Democrat congressional representative Diana DeGette, who's received over $5 million from corporate PACs, including her top contributor linked to AIPAC. Aru Shiny Ajay, executive director of the Sunrise Movement, says the path toward winning climate legislation lies toward having a functional democracy, and that includes having a democracy that doesn't prioritize endless wars abroad. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After the collapse of 21 hours of peace talks between Iran and the U.S. in Islamabad, Pakistan on April 12th, President Trump ordered a blockade of Iranian ports along the Strait of Hormuz. China, Saudi Arabia, and Spain have formally protested or criticized the U.S.-led blockade, labeling it dangerous, irresponsible, and a senseless escalation. Iran called the blockade illegal, warning that targeting its ports could put shipping across the Gulf at risk. Saudi officials reportedly warned Washington that Iran-allied Houthi rebels in Yemen could close the Bab al-Mandab Strait in the Red Sea, which has become a key shipping route after the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran was launched on February 28th. Britain and France have refused to join the U.S. in blockading Iranian ports and instead are pushing for a separate multinational effort to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Iran-U.S. negotiations focused on Washington's demand that Iran agree to a 20-year moratorium on all uranium enrichment and the physical surrender of the country's nearly 1,000 pounds of highly enriched uranium. Iran is demanding Israel halt its attack on Lebanon that has killed over 2,000 people, an end to sanctions, and Washington's release of Iran's frozen assets. There are signs that a second round of negotiations between U.S. and Iranian officials could happen before the two-week ceasefire expires on April 22nd. Your reporter spoke with Brandon Carr, studies associate at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and Kevin Harris, associate professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles. Here they discuss their views on the U.S. blockade, the fragile ceasefire, and the future of negotiations to end the war. We hear first from Brendan Carr.
I think the administration is trying to implement a blockade in order to force the regime's hand, prevent them from being able to sell any oil on international markets and deprive them of their basic economic lifeline. I think the difficulty that the Trump administration is going to run into is Iran has a lot of cards to play in response. They could decide to escalate militarily if they choose to resume the conflict. They could target our ships that are executing the blockade, and they could resume strikes on civilian targets in the Middle East and the Gulf, as well as energy infrastructure targets. The administration here in Washington is extremely sensitive to any economic headwinds that result from this war, particularly high gas prices. And this blockade has a pretty good likelihood of spiking gas prices, depending on how long it goes on for. So the blockade could very likely backfire. Now, there's been reporting that this blockade is an attempt to enhance their negotiating leverage and that there is not actually real interest in Trump himself of resuming hostilities, but that remains to be seen.
Kevin Harris, I wanted to ask you, after these negotiations between the U.S. and Iran collapsed in Pakistan over the weekend, do we know what the points of disagreement were or are?
Like many diplomatic negotiations, both sides start with maximalist positions, and given time, each side is supposed to understand what can be put on the table. let's remember that the JCPOA, which was negotiated between the government of Iran and the so-called P5 plus one, five members of the Security Council plus Germany, took 2 years to come to an agreement in 2016, which was then abrogated unilaterally by the United States under the Trump administration. So diplomacy takes a long time. The positions on both sides that are presented, at least as far as the media knows, in Islamabad were maximalist on both sides, with disagreements even on what was even mentioned at the talks. But, you know, on the Iranian side, given that they, as Brendan noted, have more cards than the United States realized at the beginning of this war, have asked for the right for nuclear enrichment at some point in the future, lifting of many of the economic sanctions imposed on Iran, and are much less willing to negotiate, although they might, on issues related to regional security, the missiles, aid to allies in the region, these kind of things. So the Iranian side, you know, brought its own list of demands to the table. As many participants in the negotiations of the JCPOA have noted today, you know, negotiations are supposed to last longer than 12 to 16 hours.
As the price of oil and fertilizer goes up, essential to agriculture and food supplies, how much pressure is building to force both the U.S. and Iran to come to an agreement to end this war? There's all these external factors. You've got countries in Asia, Southeast Asia, rationing all sorts of things, mostly energy. Thailand and some other countries have gone to 4-day work weeks. I mean, this is really having a dramatic impact. The big concern is this blocking of the Strait of Hormuz could end up pushing the world economy into a recession or something worse.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in the short term, the U.S. is insulated to a degree, but the longer that the strait is closed, the more and more this pressure is going to build. And economic headwinds in other parts of the world, including in Asia and Europe, as you noted, are going to start to reverberate here. So there is a limited time horizon for the U.S. to really win out in a war of attrition against Iran. And Iran knows that, I think, which is why you're seeing the strength of their hand in negotiating with the U.S. They do not want a return to the status quo before the war. They would like to fundamentally reconfigure their relationship with the U.S. and the broader Middle East as a result. I think the U.S. doesn't have a lot of good options to try to undercut Iranian leverage unless it was willing to significantly escalate militarily in the war using ground troops, which I do not think would be wise at all. I do not think it's worth the cost, and it's not clear that it would produce the strategic results that the U.S. seeks.
That was Brendan Carr, Studies Associate at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and Kevin Harris, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles. Find a link to the entire unedited interview by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Yale Divinity School's Center for Public Theology and Public Policy held a 3-day conference in New Haven from April 12th to the 14th, titled, What Are the Moral and Spiritual Issues of the 2026 Elections? The stated goal of the conference was to create a space where clergy and faith leaders who understand the importance of this moral moment can be equipped with a moral analysis of the landscape, a strategic assessment of the moral issues at stake, and moral action they can take with others in their communities to push the nation toward higher ground. The center's founding director, Bishop William Barber, who also serves as co-chair of the National Poor People's Campaign, held a press conference on the last day of the conference, responding to the U.S. and Israeli war in Iran and President Trump's social media posts threatening to annihilate Iran's civilization and attacking Pope Leo, a critic of the war. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us this excerpt of Bishop Barber's comments.
Why is the Pope teaching what Jesus said, getting under his skin? Mm-hmm. Why is that bothering the president so bad? This religious nationalist movement has been for so long saying that he is sent from God, mm-hmm. Franklin Graham. Well, if one was sent from God, why would you be so bothered about what Jesus said?
That's right.
It raises the question, are you trying to compete with God?
Mm-hmm.
I've said at this conference and others have agreed that in some ways what we are watching is a war on divinity.
That's right.
An attempt by a human being to shift the moral category. Mm. And for us to engage in a kind of moral deregulation where nothing is sacred anymore,
yes,
except what he said.
Mm.
An AI image of him as Jesus is blasphemy.
That's right.
It's
heresy. It's heresy. It's sinful. It's idolatrous. And even though this morning he's trying to walk it back and say it was a doctor, that's still problematic. What doctor would come in your room and say, I'm here to heal you, and the images floating around and would be bombs and missiles and fire? But this is exposing this strange madness that we've seen not just in pictures but in policy. We have this constitution that says, we have believed that certain rights are inalienable. They come from a creator. Not, we don't even say Christian, but a creator.
Right.
One who is wholly other.
Yes.
And what we are seeing now is an attempt by a person and a movement, not just this past few weeks, but for quite some time, to flip that and suggest that rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, voting rights, who has birthright citizenship, is determined by who gets 51% of the vote and who has the biggest amount of money in their treasury and who happens to be president at a particular time. And that, my friend, is a war on divinity.
That's right.
When you come to a place that you think because of a political office, you get to decide who lives and who died. And what civilization gets to be and what civilization doesn't get to be. Who gets citizenship and who doesn't. Which parts of the Constitution will matter and which rights will be respected and which rights will not be respected. I'm not just worried about what's happening now, but what the precedent of what's happening now creates even for the future.
Yes.
We learn in Scripture that once you clean the house of its basic moral premises and leave the house open and you allow certain things to go unchallenged, you make room for something to happen later that may be 7 times stronger than what you're experiencing now. We have to speak. Just 10 days ago, on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, President Trump told Russell Vaught, the director of the Federal Office of Management and Budget, don't send any money for daycare because the United States can't take care of daycare. That has to be left up to the state. We can't take care of daycare. We have all these other people and we are fighting wars. Was it not Dr. King that warned us that whenever military and violence and war is determining all the other policies, that we are on a spiral, dangerously going down? We can't take care of poor folk because we're in war, wars of choice. We can't care for children. We can't have health care. The budget that was passed, the so-called big, he called it big beautiful, we call it big dead, the ugly budget, the economists tell us all of the shell games that went on to make room for more money for war while we cut money for healing. Not only is war unholy, notice what I said, war is unholy.
Yes.
Because in an age of nuclear weapons, war itself is the challenge. But when any human or president acts in word and deed as though they can determine who lives and who dies, is heresy.
Yes.
Assuming God like authority, and again, and I keep repeating, it represents a war on divinity.
That was Bishop William Barber, founding director of the Yale Divinity School's Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. Learn more about the center's recent conference on the moral issues in the 2026 midterm election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump, who attempted to overturn the outcome of his 2020 presidential election loss by inciting a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, is now in his second term orchestrating a multi-pronged voter suppression campaign to prevent Democrats from taking control of the U.S. House and Senate. Among the schemes unleashed are unprecedented mid-decade gerrymandering in Republican-controlled states, an executive order to use the post office to eliminate mail-in voting, lawsuits against states to collect confidential voter information, pressuring Congress to pass the Save America Act that, by requiring birth certificates or passports to vote, would disenfranchise an estimated more than 20 million eligible voters. There's growing alarm about the Justice Department's seizure of ballots in Atlanta and Arizona, along with regime threats to interfere in the election by declaring a national emergency, invoking the Insurrection Act, and deploying ICE agents to intimidate voters at polling places. While the many schemes being launched to rig the election in the GOP's favor are happening in plain sight, U.S. corporate media too often downplay fact checks of the Republicans' false claim of massive voter fraud by immigrants that they argue justifies policies that make it harder for millions of Americans to vote. Your reporter spoke with Julie Holler, senior analyst with the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who talks about her recent commentary titled, "Who Will Save America?" from misleading coverage of voter suppression.
The way that media cover this influences the way that people understand it. And what we've learned from looking at both media coverage and at polls is that people don't understand it very well. So I think one of the bigger failures of media, of our, you know, corporate media outlets on this issue is just a general lack of consistently debunking all of the myths that the GOP, particularly under Trump, spread, have spread, continue spreading about the existence or how widespread any kind of vote fraud is or any kind of voting by people without citizenship in the United States. Your listeners probably mostly know that, in fact, it's very rare. There is very little vote fraud. It is not common. It is not widespread. There are very few people who are not citizens who attempt to vote in federal elections. This is actually, as also many of your listeners may know, or they may not, especially if they're younger, but this is a claim, this vote fraud claim, has been advanced by the GOP well before Trump was around. I could definitely say that going back decades, the GOP has been advancing the myth of widespread vote fraud, and the media for those decades has not, in our estimation, done a good enough job of pushing back against that. Because when you have a claim like that that's being advanced over and over again, you need to debunk it over and over again. And I think what you'll see in the corporate media is that a lot of these outlets will do maybe like this one debunking article, and then in the future, they kind of will maybe reference that in one line at some point, or maybe not even always. But there's a lack of a really consistent and forceful debunking of these kinds of myths, which is what people need to hear from them.
Julie, you note in your article that what happens in many media stories about these claims of massive voter fraud is there may be some acknowledgement that there's some facts, some statistics to back up the fact that massive voter fraud is not a problem, not anywhere near a problem. But they often revert to the false equivalence of saying, on the one hand, Democrats say this, on the other hand, Republicans say that. Journalists need to be fact checkers. They're not there to be stenographers to those people who they're reporting on. They're supposed to
tell their viewers or listeners, their readers, what's a fact and what's not.
Exactly. I mean, there's a reason that the First Amendment protects the press. There's a reason that in our democracy, the press is considered so important, and that is because you need a free press that will actually tell the people what they need to know in order to maintain that democracy. So you need to have reporters and news outlets that are not afraid to tell the truth. And what you see instead is, you know, that reliance on Democrats say one thing, Republicans say another. This is the sort of safety method that the corporate media have come to rely on, where they kind of fall back on this idea of objectivity, this idea of balance, which is a false balance. But they say, well, look, if we report what Republicans say and what Democrats say, then when Republicans complain to us or Democrats complain to us, then we can say, look, we presented both sides. So it's their way of trying to pretend that they are not biased. You know, with something like the Save America Act, it's not just Democrats who are saying that this is a problem. It is all sorts of voting rights experts. You know, you talk to anyone who cares about democracy, they will tell you that this act, it's actually not even necessarily going to help Republicans. It's not clear that suppressing the vote in all sorts of ways is going to, across the board, help Republicans in the way that Donald Trump seems to think that it will guarantee the midterms to them. And this is, we're not just talking about people in Democratic cities and Democratic strongholds. There are a lot of Trump voters who are in rural areas, who are lower income, who are going to face obstacles to voting when they're having to present ID, when they're not able to mail in ballots. This is something that is just across the board going to suppress voting. And that's bad for democracy, no matter which way you look at it.
That was Julie Holler, senior analyst with the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Find a link to her recent commentary titled "Who Will Save America from Misleading Coverage of Voter Suppression and Related Analysis" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, KGNU in Denver, Colorado, KSER in Everett, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.